It's time for Mac Geek Gab, and listener McKay brings us our quick tip of the week with on the Mac to save a screenshot to the clipboard and not to the disk, as is the default, add the control T. So, for example, if you're taking a screenshot of the entire screen, then it's saved to disk. You do it with Command, Shift, and 3. But if you want to take a screenshot of the desktop and save it to the clipboard, add the control key. So you go Control, Command, Shift, and 3. More tips like this, plus your questions answered today on Mac Geek Gab number 1051 for Monday, August 19th, 2024.
To Mac Geek Gab, the show where we take your quick tips like that, we take you and share them. We take your cool stuff out and we share them. We take your questions, easy for me to say, and share them and hopefully answer them. We loosely string it all together into an agenda that gives us all a great opportunity to learn at least 5 new things every single time we get together. Our sponsor for this episode is 1Password Extended Access Management, which solves all the problems that traditional IAM and MDM can't touch. We'll talk more about that a little bit later here in the show. And in the show notes, we have a link where you can learn more, too. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Here on this National Aviation Day here in Durham, New Hampshire.
Hey,
I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in South Dakota, I'm Adam Christensen.
And here back in New Hampshire, it's Pilot Pete. Good to be back with you guys this week.
We missed you
good
last
to have
week.
You back.
Yeah.
Yeah, with every shot you took.
you came back on the right week, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. National Perfect. Aviation Day.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Or day, even.
All right. Well, so, with that in mind, I think we should take off, Dave.
I wanted to add to, thank you, I got the reference, and nicely done. The quick tip that you shared, I love the reminder that adding the control key to those key combinations is what decides whether or not to send it to the clipboard or not. I love the way you and McKay phrased that. You mentioned control, command, shift 3, taking the entire desktop. That takes all your screens, if you have multiple screens, just as a reminder. Yeah. Command, shift 4 lets you do either, or command, control, shift 4, again, to send it to the clipboard. Command, shift 4 lets you, it pulls up the crosshairs. You can draw on the screen, and whatever you draw with the crosshairs will be captured, or you can hit the space bar when the crosshair is up, and that will change you to a camera icon, which should be self-explanatory. As you float it over different windows, it highlights those windows. A single click will then take a screenshot with a drop shadow of that particular window so that you can either include it or paste it somewhere. All of this goes out the window with Command Shift 5, which is Apple's new, and it's really not that new, screen capture functionality, which lets you see all of these options as opposed to having to remember them all. So, any more to add to that, Adam? I saw you nodding along.
No, I mean, the camera one is interesting too, depending upon what element you hover over, because I think it will also capture like just the dock or just the menu bar. If you go to the menu bar, I'm pretty sure. And I would assume if you have a expanded menu, it would capture the top menu bar and the drop down menu, but I'm not positive on that one. I've never tried it.
Yeah, the so I had no idea that it would capture the menu bar or the dock, so thank you. I learned 2 things there. With drop down menus, thank you, Pete. With drop down menus, if you hover over the drop down menu, it will only capture the drop-down menu. It doesn't capture the entire menu bar. So that's just something to
Does it at least capture what menu you're in, or is it only the expanded little...
Let me see what I'm about to copy.
Squircle. Squircle, right? That's the right term for...
Yeah, let me
rectangle.
See what it puts in there. No, it is only the part that has dropped down.
Yeah, so that I feel like that's missing something because, you know, you might not know what all the elements in that, if you're sending that to somebody,
yeah,
drop down are like, is that the edit menu or is that the file menu? I mean, most
I
of
have
us
to,
know, but like
I have to use, yeah, when I often use that for replying to listener emails. And in those cases, I use the crosshairs to, I drop down the menu, then do command control shift 4 and use the crosshairs on the dropped down menu to like get the context of which menu it is. Exactly to your point.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And the only other thing that, you know, I like about like the new system where when you take a screenshot without sending it to the clipboard and you get that little preview, I like the ability to click on that preview and then use markup to put arrows and draw, you know, draw around things and put text and
yes, yes.
So and then,
yes.
Based on that, I have to add that I don't use the Apple standard personally. I for a couple years now I've been using Shotter, Shottr, and that brings up a little window whereupon you can mark up your image, and then you have two icons there. One is a copy icon, which means send it to the clipboard, or a diskette icon, which means send it to a file. And I actually, it saves it to a subfolder in your downloads folder, where then you can go back and grab them or delete them as needed. But I find Shotter incredibly powerful. You can blur out portions, you can edit text, you can highlight, you can do all kinds of neat stuff with it. In fact, I think Allison on her podcast has, or her website has a whole thing on using Shotter. And it's really expensive now. It's $8 for an incredibly powerful.
I have Shotter. We've mentioned it on the show before, and that's why I have it. I haven't integrated it into my workflow. In fact, I haven't even integrated the Command Shift 5 into my workflow other than one specific thing, which I'll explain in a minute. But I'm so ingrained in the Command Shift 4, really. I rarely use 3 even. It's 4 and I get my thing and I do what I want. I know other people, I know there are people that like Shotter. I know that there are people that like CleanShot X. The latter is included in SetApp, if that's a thing. I haven't integrated either. And there are folks that say, well, the Command Shift 5 functionality does enough of that for me that I am happy to just use Apple's. And it's great that there are all these options. One piece of advice that, or one additional tip that I will share while we're here is, And I've done this with Apple's functionality using the Onyx app, because with the Onyx app, you can define where screenshots are saved. Actually, you can also do that with the Command Shift 5 functionality, right? You can choose a folder. But with Onyx, you could choose a folder for the ones with the old interface. And for years, I have saved my screenshots to a folder that is synced to all of my Macs. So it doesn't matter where I have taken a screenshot. I have it everywhere. And that has been, if I'm saving it to disk, most of my screenshots go to the clipboard and are transient. You know, they come and they go. But the ones that I want to save, I save to a synced folder. I put it on my Synology drive. It used to be on my Dropbox. And that's one of those kind of game changer things, in my opinion. So wanted
that
to share.
Is brilliant to do it to a synced folder across all machines. Yeah, I never thought of doing that, but that's going in my workflow right now.
Yeah, it was one of those things where I was like on my laptop and did a screenshot and then was in the office. And of course, my laptop now is closed and asleep, so I cannot even remote into it. Like I have to go. And it was like, I need that screenshot. This sucks. This has to be everywhere. I need to know. And I was like, wait, I can solve this problem. So like I said, it goes back to when I was using Dropbox before Synology Drive ever existed or whatever. So yeah.
Yep. I have the same.
Yep.
A folder in my documents that syncs to everything.
Oh yeah. You can just put it in iCloud Drive too. That's right.
Yeah. That's where I have mine.
Yeah. Smart. And then that way they're easily accessible from your phone too.
Yeah. You know, I have this vague memory because I know that that's not, there's tricks for setting that up. I think there's a terminal command you can use, but obviously, like you said, you know, you can just do it in Onyx or whatever.
Yeah. It's just a terminal command. You're totally right. Yeah.
But I have this vague memory that I thought there used to be, and I just looked, it's not there. So maybe this is one of those false memories, but I thought there used to be a way to set that in the image capture app.
Oh,
I think that's where that setting was. That's my vague memory, but, and I thought that's where I had set it up originally, but I could be wrong. I don't know.
You might be right.
That could be a mismemory.
I do recall there being, like, long, long ago, that there being an Apple way of doing it that didn't involve the terminal. But when you said it, I was like, oh, I remember that being in like system preferences or something. And then you said image capture and it was like, oh, maybe it was there. I don't remember. But yeah, it was somewhere. Huh? Feedback at MacGeekGab.com, folks. If you remember these important tidbits of now useless information, please let us know.
Yeah. You heard that feedback at MacGeekGab. Speaking
of say.
Saying it easy, feedback at MacGeekGab.com.
I'll help you with that, Pete. It's Thank feedback you. At MacGeekGab.com.
Finally right. got there.
All right. Are we, Raymond yeah. Raymond has a tip. Let me take us there. He says, I have an M1 Mac Mini that is working fine. On Friday, I did the upgrade to 14.6.1 as the system was telling me to upgrade. So I went to bed, and the next morning when I look at the computer, I noticed that I no longer had any audio coming out of the headphone jack on the Mac Mini. I tested my speakers and they were working fine, so I rebooted the computer and no luck. Still no audio. So then I shut it down and wait a little bit, rebooted, still no luck, still no audio. The audio worked fine before I did the upgrade, so something with 14.6.1 was the problem. Since I have extended AppleCare on the computer, I called Apple, and all they had me do was reinstall the OS on the Mac Mini, which took a long time, but after the reinstall, the audio then worked. Strange that the software update would kill audio, and I wonder if others have this issue too. The way to do this, he says, is the path I just shut down and restarted my Mac holding the power key so I could get to the reinstall the OS page from Apple, and then it all worked. So what was interesting to me about this one is I didn't know that had changed because I'm still on Intel Mac, and I've never had to reinstall the OS on my Office Apple Silicon Mac, and actually I couldn't, probably. I didn't know the new method was press and hold the power, keep the power button held down to get to the recovery screen on a Silicon Mac. So I learned that from this. But then also I was like curious about the change. And so I looked up the support article on Apple's website. And apparently if you're not on a Silicon Mac, you're on an old Intel Mac. I always knew you rebooted the machine and then press and held down Command R to get to the recovery screen. Apparently there's some other options. If you do Command Option R, it says it will offer the latest Mac OS that is compatible with your Mac as the recovery install. And if you hold Shift Option Command R, then it will try to install the version that came originally with your Mac or the closest version that's still available.
Oh.
And I had no idea that was a thing.
Well, there's my at least number two.
Yeah. This what interested me about this was, you know, when Raymond wrote in, explained the solution. It was like, okay, like it's good for us to remember what I think for years on this show anyway, I don't know if this is an official term, but we've called the maintenance reinstall, right? Where you're reinstalling the operating system over the top of itself, essentially, on your Mac, hopefully replacing some damaged, corrupt, missing
that
files.
One byte that's off that should be on.
Right. But like, that's a quick way of doing it that usually doesn't have any destructive effects. It's always good to have a backup, but you know, the idea is you're just putting the operating system back on, all your data, your apps, your settings basically remain as they were. And as I was reading it, I was like, well, this is interesting. Apple guided Raymond to do this. How did Apple guide you to do this? Because my brain that is stuck in the world of important tidbits of no longer relevant information was like, oh, yeah, you just go online, you download the installer, and then you run the installer from your thing. I was like, but does Apple advise that? I know you can still do that, and that's the path I would have taken, but it was interesting to hear Apple's path is, oh, no. Don't you can skip. You can do it all at once by with Apple Silicon, as you mentioned, the power button, and then the other ways with Intel. So, yeah, it's good stuff.
So I have one other thing to add, and I'll put this. We'll make sure this link goes in the show notes.
Yeah,
because this comes up every time I've ever had somebody talk about reinstalling macOS, and that is, how do I download or get a copy of any version of macOS? And there's a few different ways, but there is a support article on Apple's website that lets you know how to do it. So use software update, use macOS recovery. A lot of people know that. But this article has the links to all of the versions because they don't just come up. If you open the App Store, a lot of people know you can go to the App Store. You can only usually find the latest version of the operating system, but they're still all in there. You just need the links. So this article has the links going all the way back to High Sierra for the App Store. And then in addition, they have the downloads for Sierra all the way back to Lion on this page. So
nice.
Huh?
Yeah.
Love that.
You can That's get old versions of macOS. Yeah. They're just hard to find for a lot of people.
Yeah. I didn't realize Apple had links to them. I mean, I knew there were third party resources with links to them. I didn't realize Apple was like, yeah, just come, you know, there you go.
Come get them from us.
Come get them from us. Well, you're always getting them from Apple, even with the third party links. It just was.
Yep.
Yeah.
They just had hidden these links for a long, long time. I don't know when they added this article, but I found it. It was published April 2nd, 2024. So
yeah,
I think prior to that, these were very hard to find.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh? Cool. Loving this. This is great.
Yeah.
Or
you could get them from downloadsrus.northkorea, you know.
Well, that's the thing is you don't want that. And I always made sure when I found the, you know, the third party web page like this that listed things, that they were pointing to, you know, something.apple.com or, you know, whatever, right. So that you were like, yeah. The next one sort of blew me away and I think will be very handy for people. Grumpy, there was a whole thread on this, so I'm sort of synthesizing a bunch of data from our MacGeekup.com/Discord chat, which if you're not there, I can't recommend it enough. It's such a great community and everybody helps each other. And somebody was venting actually in the fist shakes category about how people not using one of the big three carriers here in the U.S. were not able to buy an iPhone from Apple using their Apple Card financing terms. Right. It used to be that you could buy just a regular unlocked phone, carrier-less unlocked phone, and using Apple's financing and then apply whatever carrier like a Mint Mobile or a Visible or whatever you want to it. That changed last year. The only way you could buy a phone was to use T-Mobile, AT&T or Verizon, right? So that with payment terms from Apple. Obviously, you could buy phones from other people. However, there is a solution if you want to use Visible or Mint or any other non-big three carrier and still finance your phone from Apple. And this is relevant because I think we're coming up to a new iPhone season. Grumpy Mike says, when I purchased my iPhone 15 Pro Max for my wife last September, I was surprised to see that I was unable to finance a carrier-free phone. During the reservation process, I started a chat with Apple support. And here are some things that I learned. Number one, all phones purchased from Apple are unlocked. Ah, this is a good, this is an important tidbit of information. Number two.
Amen.
Yes. As indicated on Apple's financing website, you can change providers at any time after you receive the phone. So he says, for me as a Mint Mobile user, I just selected T-Mobile as my carrier. I bypassed the cell setup when I got the phone. He says, actually, I tried the eSIM transfer, which failed, which was sort of a normal process for those of us with Mint. You just need to set up a new eSIM on the phone. He says, then when the phone was up and running, I installed the Mint app, the carrierless, or the, it was a T-Mobile phone that he had not activated with T-Mobile, got the phone up and running, installed the Mint app on it, and set up the eSIM. It has been working fine ever since, so 11 months in, paying each month on the Apple Card, and the phone shows as no restrictions under settings about carrier lock. I didn't even know that setting was there. He says, I went back to my order to confirm, and sure enough, it shows that it's, you know, the T-Mobile no commitment is written right on the order, and so... this is the path. If you want to finance a new iPhone 16, I assume that's what they'll call it, in a month or less, then you still can put whatever carrier you were on or whatever carrier you want on it. So,
might be the 15S. I think they're done with that.
Let's hope, man.
No.
But you're right. It could
let's
be.
Let's not go back there.
You're not. Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So that was fun. I got to miss almost all of that because my audio interface decided to just die.
Oh,
so
fun.
Hopefully that doesn't happen.
We
again.
Recorded it for you, Adam. You can listen back after the show.
Go back and watch.
MGG.fm.
MGG.fm. That'll get you there. /1051. That'll get you right to this episode. That's right. Let's keep on trucking here. This is fun. So,
yeah.
You want to take us to Scott, Pete?
Scott writes in, and he's very generous. He starts off with gents. Thank you, Scott. It's in episode 1049, Brian asked about how to selectively unlock my Mac with Apple Watch, and it was a geek challenge. He says, I solved this problem not long ago by using BLE Unlock, an applet that lives in my menu bar. BLE Unlock allows you to both lock and unlock your Mac based on the time you're away from your Mac, the proximity of the device you choose. I use my watch, but you can use your phone if you wish, and the time you're away. For example, I have mine to set to lock my Mac when I am further away than about 20 feet as calculated by the relative signal strength, RSSI strength, for more than 30 seconds. You can set your device to unlock using the same parameters. I choose, as does Pilot Pete, to use fingerprint ID on my Apple keyboard instead, but I've experimented with unlocking via BLE Unlock, and it works perfectly. I highly recommend it, and the price is right. It's free. Thank you, Scott.
Huh. Well, I know we've talked about this on the show before. Obviously, I forgot about it because it didn't come up when we talked about it 2 weeks ago. But, yeah, that would be the easiest answer to this.
Sure.
The only thing, I'm looking at the feature set, and I didn't download it or mess with it, but the only thing that would be interesting would be a location-based trigger. So, or a location-based filter. So if I am at home, unlock my Mac if my watch comes near it. But if I'm at Starbucks, make me unlock it a different way, right? And I realize your Mac doesn't always get great location data, but you could do it potentially based on IP address because you know the IP range of your home network, and you could say, if we're on this IP range, do it this way. And now I'm wondering, is there a Keyboard Maestro? Because Keyboard Maestro can do scripts based on, or triggers based on that. I wonder, is there a, I don't know. I don't think so, because it's got to be unlocked for Keyboard Maestro to do its magic. Maybe not. No, it doesn't. Huh. Yeah, I don't know. I'm thinking. So the wheels
are turning. I'll just add, just in case. I mean, I know we're all nerds here, but for those who are not, BLE stands for Bluetooth Low Energy.
Thank you for that. That doesn't necessarily just because we're here doesn't mean we know the answer to that. Thank you. Yeah.
I knew it. I simply choose not to remember it.
Right. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Ben had another answer to this, which might also solve the problem. And that was, he says, I recommend after pressing the shortcut, which by default is Control Command Q in the Apple menu, he then press Escape twice. Doing so first backs out of the specific user login to the list of users, and the second turns off the display. I believe from the dark screen, the nearby Apple Watch will not automatically unlock. However, upon pressing a key to wake the screen, Apple Watch will then unlock it. So this, yet another creative solution to this, which doesn't require any software, free or otherwise. It's all built in. But yeah, I think that's right. I think escaping to the you need to pick a list of users screen and then escaping again and putting it to sleep. Huh. I didn't even know about those two screens. I like that. Huh. I got to remember this because sometimes, like, I'll leave my laptop on the couch to do an update. And of course, I have to leave it open and running, but it doesn't need to be unlocked. And this is a good way of doing that. And mainly it's the cats walking across the keyboard would be the reason I would want to keep it locked.
Before they go and order lots of cat toys on Amazon.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Puck's bad at that. Definitely likes his catnip. So we got to ration it.
Before we move to the next one, because those worked in well, and this is kind of in the geek challenge range, I want to ask a quick geek challenge.
Yeah.
And maybe you guys know, I don't know. I've got the iPhone 15 Pro Max.
Yep.
And the camera on that thing is, as those who have one know, is phenomenal. But what I found difficult on my recent trip was doing it in HDR. There's no HDR mode on it anymore that I'm able to find. If someone knows how to do HDR, I would love to hear it, because I had difficulty. I could either get the background to be in perfect lighting or the foreground, but I would have a dark foreground and a bright background, or a bright foreground and an overly washed out background. And I could not figure it out anyway. So if someone has some HDR, even an HDR app for taking photos.
Yeah, I wonder if like halide camera would be the thing. I didn't. I know it does video with HDR.
Yeah.
Will it do?
I was not able to find an HDR mode for stills.
I can't look at my camera app, but I think they move a bunch of things under like a.
There's a little chevron.
Little drop down. Yeah, chevron. It's not under there.
It's not that I found. So, you know, you can change the aspect ratio and all that kind of stuff. But if it's there, I just didn't find it. So a quick geek challenge to folks. If they have a favorite way of taking HDR photos with the 15 Pro Max, I would be thrilled to hear what it is.
Let's see. Apple's webpage, adjust HDR camera settings on iPhone. Says, I don't know why I can't add my my thing to the screen. Something's wrong with my setup here. But it says high dynamic range in the camera app helps you get great shots, blah, blah, blah. By default, iPhone takes photos in HDR for both the rear and the front camera when it chooses its most effective. iPhone 12, 13, 14, and 15 models also record video in HDR. Turning off automatic HDR is something that you can do. You go to settings, and of course, I'm on iOS 18.1 beta, so I may not have this. But if you go to settings, camera, this is what Apple's saying. There is a smart HDR option in there, and I'm not seeing that in iOS 18.1. But is it there for you? Or you don't have your phone up?
I my phone is my camera for the show, so yes. I don't know.
Okay.
But I will definitely go back and look at that.
Yeah.
So I found it it was not good in the still mode, no matter what I was doing. So I either turned it off inadvertently sometime back.
Yeah.
Or it's the setting has changed and it's not as good as it used to be.
Yep.
So.
Yep. It is interesting that that setting is not there on 18.1. But I have put this link in the show notes. I would assume it's relevant for iOS 17, because why would they have it on a knowledge base if it wasn't? So,
yeah.
I'm looking to see, is there like a new, do they call it something different? Not that I see. So, interesting. Cool.
It's supposed to just work and doesn't.
It's supposed to just work. That's right. Raph has a follow-up. While we're in the follow-up section here, Adam, Raph has a question for you. He says, in 1047, you stated that you encoded your DVD collection and never wanted to do it again. What software did you use? He says, I did the same thing 4 to 5 years ago using Mac X DVD Pro on my 2012 Air. And he said, needless to say, it took time. And I was feeling kind of meh by the result when I compared the video quality streaming with Plex from my Synology. I recently tried to re-encode using Make MKV on my M2 Pro and ended up with a similar result. No matter the format, the software, the Mac, the video quality, especially when it's a dark scene, isn't as good as playing the DVD itself from the drive. What did you do that might have helped?
Yeah, I didn't really do anything that would help. I can tell you the software that I use again, which is Mac DVD Ripper Pro, which I think is excellent. The issue with resolution on a DVD, ripping a DVD, is first of all, when you're doing it, you're applying compression. And in dark scenes, in scenes with heavy water, the encoders just have a hard time with that, right? And you're already starting from a lower resolution place with a DVD these days, you know, then you've got to upscale to 4K and all this other stuff. So I've just generally found like you're going to suffer from that a little bit when you're ripping and compressing. Now, I think he mentioned, you know, should I just archive every DVD using the ISO format? And I believe that Plex will handle those. I didn't do ISOs. So basically, you're just making a direct copy of the source DVD. I think that would help because you're not going to have the compression. You're going to have a much larger file. The other nice thing about that, too, is I think that preserves like the DVD menus and the extra features and all that. Like, it's like you just put a DVD into a drive. You just don't have it in a drive. So I think that would be an option. The other thing that I noticed was I have Mac DVD Ripper Pro, and it says on their website they have a new AI-powered super resolution upscaling feature. So I haven't, you know, because I did this a long time ago, and like I said, I never wanted to redo it again, but I haven't tried checking out that feature. So I don't know if that would help with some of the resolution compression issues or not, but.
Yeah, this is interesting. I'm wondering, I thought Make MKV didn't compress it. It would transcode it or, you know, turn it into the MKV file, but that was it. I thought that was an uncompressed version. But if the DVD was encoded with HDR and the rip, or the Blu-ray was encoded with HDR and the rip doesn't grab that HDR metadata, then you would wind up with exactly what he's talking about here. So, yeah, I feel like, yeah, that Mac DVD Ripper Pro is probably the way to go. I see that, excuse me, Walter in the chat says that's what he uses too. So maybe it does solve some of that. Yeah.
It's a great app. It's just really easy to use and it just does it. And I've never had issues with any DVDs. Like sometimes certain apps have issues with specific studio DVDs and stuff like that.
Yes.
Just not ripping. And this one's, I've just gone back to over and over again through the years. So.
And will it rip Blu-rays as well? If you have a Blu-ray reader, obviously you need a hardware for that.
That I do not know, because I never got into the whole Blu-ray thing. I went straight from DVD to just buying my movies from Apple.
Yep. Interesting, because that's always been the trick. Hockey Brian says it does not work on Blu-ray.
Yeah, I didn't think it did.
You need to go back to make MKV and then also make MKV on Blu-rays, because that's kind of the trick. And yeah, that's where things get interesting. So, all right. Well, I will put links to all of that, including the make MKV Blu-ray instructions, because there's like a whole thing you got to do. But anyway, we talked in episode 1049 about mounting drives and unmounting drives. And
we did.
I think listener Peter is going to help get us back into that topic.
He did. And since it's my namesake, Peter writes in, "Hey guys, there was indeed an app called Mountain. It stopped working properly a few upgrades ago. I still had a copy in my applications folder, but when I just tried to run it, I got the app is damaged message. So it's goodbye to that. I had a similar problem as the one you talked about on today's episode. The drive I use for Carbon Copy Cloner never seemed to eject cleanly, especially when I was in a hurry to pick up my MacBook and get it off the desk and go. Mountain was the fix when it worked. My solution after Mountain stopped being useful involves a smart plug, home assistant, and Keyboard Maestro. I have an automation set up in Keyboard Maestro that sees the OWC Thunderbolt hub that I have on my desk and asks me if I want to turn on the backup drive. If I say yes, it tells Home Assistant to turn on the smart plug. Carbon Copy Cloner then sees the drive mount and runs a backup. When it's done, CCC tells me to drive to eject, which in turn triggers another Keyboard Maestro operation or automation to turn off the smart plug. The drive can't be remounted unless that plug is turned back on, which only happens when I want it. That is elegant.
Smart plugs, man, there are so many things that can be done with smart plugs. I mean, I know we can use them to turn on like our favorite lamp or something, right? Like, yeah. Great. All good. And that's the use case that seems to be pushed out by the vendors of smart plugs. But
sure,
the best thing for smart plugs is dealing with those annoying things where something needs to be powered off or powered on in an automated way. Like my garage door opener, that if it, for whatever reason, that like my the smart home garage door opener, the old Chamberlain home kit thing that I have that everybody wants but nobody can buy anymore, if that's on for more than like 2 or 3 days, it gets wonky and needs to be power cycled. So I just have a smart home automation that with a smart plug that it plugs into, and the smart plug turns off for 30 seconds at 5:32 a.m. every day, and that solves the problem. I had put a powered but not smart bidet attachment on one of our toilets years ago, and I couldn't figure out how to get it to stop beeping when you sat down on it. Finally, we did figure out that there was a like you hold your mouth just right and not near the bidet, and you know, push the right button.
It's a
button.
Drinking fountain.
No,
hold your mouth right.
Nope. And there was a path to do it, but it wasn't in the instruction manual. So the solution was great. I put a smart plug in front of the bidet, and I have it triggered with my sleep focus. So when I tell my iPhone that I am going to sleep, it turns off the smart plug. And when I come out of sleep focus, it turns on the smart plug. I used a Meross plug for that because they're great for with HomeKit. And they work great. Like, it solved the problem. And so, like, yeah. Yep, smart plugs. Love it. Love it.
Yeah.
Yep.
I wish I'd invented one.
Well, you know, there's still time. A lot of people have smart plugs, Pete. Listener Michael, also to solve the ejecting your drives properly and when you want problem, says, "I have been using an app that I found through a YouTube video from the St. Clair software folks who make Default Folder, and the app is called Jettison. And he says Jettison works great for ejecting SSDs from a docking station, studio display, or whatever. He says, I'm in a similar situation as listener Terry from episode 1049. I have a studio display at home that I bought mainly for my M2 Air, as I have a 4 terabyte Time Machine drive for my family's Macs and a 2 terabyte external drive used for Backblaze and other files. When I connect my work M3 Air, I would prefer to not connect my personal drives and instead plug in my work's Time Machine drive. There's a 15-day trial for Jettison from St. Clair. In my opinion, it's completely worth the $4.95 price for one license, and additional licenses are available for a dollar less than that. He says it lives as a menu bar icon. That is one of the few that I choose to keep visible while using Bartender 5. It's super handy. Older versions of macOS would have issues in the past with the every once in a while seeing a use the finder to force eject. But I will say, ever since macOS 14, aka Sonoma, was released, I don't think I've seen that message more than once. So thank you, Michael. Great stuff. Great stuff. Love, love, love that. And thanks to everybody for writing in with all your tips and your follow-ups and all that good stuff.
All right, folks, imagine that your company's security is like the quad of a college campus, right? So you've got those nice brick paths, the company-owned devices, IT-approved apps, managed employee identities. But let's be real, who actually stays on the brick paths, right? We all know the real action happens on those worn-down shortcuts across the grass, the unmanaged devices, shadow IT apps, and contractors who swear they are following the rules. Most security tools only work on those happy brick paths. But what about the shortcuts? Don't get caught with your data wandering off the beaten path. Enter our sponsor, 1Password Extended Access Management, the superhero of security solutions. It's the first tool that brings all those unmanaged devices, apps, and identities under control. It's like having a digital sheepdog rounding up all those rogue devices and keeping them in line. Woof! Whether it's a contractor with a mystery laptop or an app you didn't even know existed, 1Password Extended Access Management secures every sign-in on every app and device. It's the solution traditional IAM and MDM can't touch. Because let's face it, who can keep up with all those shortcuts? So don't get caught in the security wilderness. Check out 1Password Extended Access Management at 1Password.com/product/XAM. That's 1Password.com/product/XAM. I'll put that link in the show notes at MacGeekGab.com so you can just click right through if you want. Your data deserves a little security magic. And our sponsor, 1Password Extended Access Management, deserves some thanks for being our sponsor. So thanks for being our sponsor. And don't get caught. Go check it out.
So yeah. Joe has a question.
Uh-oh. What's Joe's question?
Joe says, how do I adjust the timestamp of photos on my Mac? I've played with the options, Googled, and I'm at a bit of a loss. How can you organize or sort photos in an album on iCloud Photos? Coming back off a two-week trip to Europe, oh, that sounds nice, spent time in exported photos from non-Apple Mac photo app and got all in order and numbered. And added screenshots of maps ahead of each group of photos for We Were Here purposes. The photos show up in iCloud Photos in order, which is timestamp order, but the map screenshots are all lumped at the end. I can't seem to manually rearrange. I tried Get Info to change the timestamp by 1 second or something. You can't. And iCloud Photos does not seem to at all sort any or... Photos does not seem to all any sort of
probably allow arranging. I think is what he's trying to say.
Oh, does not allow. Hey, there you go. Not allow any sort of arranging or sorting. It's simply fixed thoughts. And then Joe from Raleigh.
Yeah, Joe, I think you're right that this is not something you can do on iCloud Photos. However, you can do this in Apple Photos and like in the Photos app, either on your iPhone or on your Mac, and highlight the photo, go to the image menu on your Mac and choose adjust date and time. A little screen will come up. You can adjust the date and the time and even the time zone and all of that stuff. And it will do it for one photo or multiple photos. Sounds like for your purposes, you'd want to do it for one photo at a time so that you can properly, you know, get things where they need to be in, you know, those map screenshots. If you want to do this on your iPhone, you have to tap to bring up the single picture. You can't do it from the carousel display. Bring up the single picture and then tap the three little dot, dot, dots at the top or the eye at the bottom, and you can do the same thing. You can adjust the timestamp right there, and then that will sync to your devices and all is well. So hopefully that helps.
But wait, there's more. So in a program you may or may not have heard of, it's called SetApp. You can get an app called Meta Image. And man, does this thing let you get granular. You can do almost anything with the metadata in your images. Obviously change the file name, change the date and time that it was created. But you can add in there all kinds of things, comments, copyrights, headlines, caption abstracts, object names, latitude, longitude.
Oh, wow.
Or take it out of there. You know, obviously, if you want to post something on social media, you probably want to pull your location data out, particularly if it's your home and you don't want people showing up on your front door asking for your autograph or trying to shoot you or both. It is amazing how granular that can get. And that's included. It's Meta Image. It's in SetApp. And that allows you to do all kinds of fun stuff with the details behind your photos. And I think I could be wrong. My recollection is that I've been able to adjust other metadata on other files.
Oh, interesting.
Not just image files.
I see that there is a photos extension included too, which is super helpful.
I forgot to mention that. It allows you to pull from a folder or directly from photos.
Yeah.
To adjust it.
That's
so
key. That is key. Cool. Great stuff.
Yeah.
Fun.
Yeah.
Nicole has a question for us. Nicole says, I got into the original AirPods in 2020 and then the Pros a year later. I record videos for my side hustle. And for some time, I was able to do that with the audio coming from my AirPods. I take long gaps between making these videos, so I don't know when things changed, but audio is no longer captured by my AirPods when using the native camera app to record my videos. What the heck is this? Whose idea was that? Or is there some evil hidden setting I don't know about? This has significantly compromised my productivity in video recording and related income. I'm frustrated. I can't find any mention of this feature / flaw in Apple support. Thank you, Nicole. Adam, do you have thoughts about this? Okay, good.
Well, I heard this and I was like immediately like, no, this is not a thing, right? This can't be a thing. And then I did poking around, probably like Nicole did, and searched and looked at Reddit and looked at, you know, Stack Overflow and Apple support things. And it came to the conclusion, like a lot of people, that no, this just doesn't work. You cannot do it with the native camera app. So you're going to have to find some other tool. And a bunch of people recommended one of my favorite, like, super video recording apps, which is called Filmic Pro, which apparently does this. I've never personally tried it. So I'm going off of, you know, reports from others. But yeah, Filmic Pro, which is a great video recording app where you can do all kinds of real things. And so if you are doing videos, you know, for a side hustle, it has a lot of nice advanced features, and I don't remember it being particularly expensive. I don't think it's cheap, but I don't remember the price on it. I just bought it right away because it was a great app. I want to say it was like 12, 15 bucks, might be 20 bucks.
I'm looking to see it's on the App Store. So I have to wait for the App Store app to load. And I had to wait for Safari to relaunch because I have that problem today where Safari just goes belly
doesn't
up.
Doesn't want to play.
Doesn't want to show me things. Great. Filmic Pro is not compatible with this device, so I can't even see the price.
Oh, because you're...
Because I'm on my...
I'll look it up.
Yeah, yeah.
You guys have any other thoughts on this? And then I'll...
I did the same thing.
$14.99.
Thank you, Pete.
There you go.
Great.
Yep.
I did the same thing. I was like, no, that's got to work. And I even tried it with my AirPods sitting at my desk. I was like... And I made little, like... You know, sounds near the microphone on my phone and near the microphone on my AirPods to confirm, like, where is it coming from? And for sure it was coming from my phone's microphone, no matter what. And saw the advice. I don't think I've ever used Filmic Pro, but that sure looks like the right app to use for this.
Ooh. Yeah. Okay, all right. And I'm sorry. I read the headline. I went to buy Filmic Pro in the App Store expecting it to be $14.99, but it was free. Well,
it's free.
Free to download. But yes. To open the app, it's $4.99 a week. Ouch.
Uh-huh.
The app used to cost $14.99. It's now $250 a year with additional fees for syndicate, remote,
etc. Wait. Are you sure?
I'm reading this is off of Reddit. So,
Reddit's wrong.
Reddit's wrong.
I have,
oh, good,
well,
good. Thank you.
I think Reddit is wrong because I have Apple's App Store preview website up on my Mac, and it lists the in-app purchases. And I would trust that what's published here is actually what's going to happen on the app because Apple's probably in sync with itself. Not always. But they say that a yearly, you get a free trial, but a Filmic yearly license is $39.99. So...
I see it. Okay. Yeah. But and then those were all those other extras that are added in.
Yeah.
Creator
maybe.
Weekly, director weekly.
Right. Yeah. You can do a week trial for $1.99. You can, or actually, you can do a week, a free trial plus the weekly thing for $1.99. So there's a free trial, clearly. Try that out, Nicole. Hopefully it does it. And if so, maybe the $40 for the year with your side hustle will, you know, make that a tax deductible expense.
It.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's a bummer. Yeah, like I got it for $15. I might have an old version then,
because
they do that thing often when they move to subscription where they have a new version. I think my old version still works. I haven't used it in a while. But.
Yeah. Yep.
Bummer.
Well, you know, Adam, you mentioned something cryptic. What happened?
Yeah. I almost got caught this week. It was bad. We were having a really nice dinner this past weekend. I had a friend over and I did smoked barbecue spare ribs and smoked them for like 6 hours, and they were delicious and we were having a great time, and we kind of were wrapping up dinner and just having conversation. And my wife said to me, "Oh, remember that video of my daughter when she was, I think, about 7 or 8 years old, maybe a little younger. And she told a story that was about her teacher going to Mexico and there was a macaw and this whole series of events happened." And she's like, can you show that video? And I went, sure. I'm going to pop into my, you know, iPhone and find the video. Couldn't find it. Could not find it. It wasn't in Photos. It wasn't in the TV app. And what I had done is I had all of those videos. I have had a ton of videos of my kids growing up, all these videos I had done. There was like a 4th of July speech one my daughter gave and this whole interaction I had with my other daughter. We were playing Hungry, Hungry Hippos. That was hilarious. Like all these precious videos, right? All gone. Like, where are these videos? And I went, well, they used to live in, I think it was, what did we have before the Apple TV app? It was like just videos or movies.
Was it movies? Was it? Yeah, it was in the movies. Was it? I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
It was like the movie app. And you had your purchased movies, and there was a section called Home Videos.
Yes.
And they all lived in Home Videos, and they were synced to iCloud and all of that stuff. So I believe what happened was when they moved to the TV app, I don't know where those were supposed to go, if they were supposed to go someplace, but they were just gone. like literally gone. And I kind of had a freak out right there at dinner. And my wife's like, no, it's really okay. And I'm like, no, it's not this okay. Is not okay.
Yeah, it's actually not.
Yeah, not okay.
He's like, if you had, I have backups for this. I am like fanatic about that. There's no way I've lost these videos. Couldn't find them anywhere. I was like, you know, I would have thought they would have moved to the Photos app, but I sync iCloud Photos. They weren't there. So I'm kind of panicking. And so I grab my laptop and I run out to the office because this is where my like archive drives are. Plug in the drives. First one wasn't mounting. And it's like, you know, but I'm in panic mode. So I'm like, okay, take a deep breath. You know, you have these somewhere, but they weren't in Backblaze. They weren't. And I'm like, I know I have archives. They're either on the Drobo or they're on one of these old drives. And sure enough, I went and back and I found an old archive of my media library, which is where all the movies like and home videos things lived. And they were all in there. So I grabbed them. I immediately put them in a place where they're going to be backed up to Backblaze. And I immediately also put them into iCloud Photos now. So they all live in Photos. And then I let my laptop for a day or two just open and sync all the videos to, I created an album called Home Videos, and put them in there. So now they're synced and they're it's fine, but whew, it was scary for a moment.
Wait a minute though. Whoa. That like, that makes me wonder. I'm yeah. using every bit of self-control I can muster to not stop what we're doing and go.
See
Jake,
you guys later.
Yeah,
I
later.
Got stuff to look for.
I got stuff to look for here. Like, whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah. I need to go back and do my research to find out if they did move them somewhere and then I did something to
sure
take them out of that place, you know, inadvertently. I don't know literally what happened, because I seem to remember I thought they were supposed to go into the TV app, but they're definitely not there, or mine aren't. And I don't think you can put home videos into the TV app anymore. So the only other logical place for them to have been moved, in my opinion, would have been into videos and photos.
But, yes. Yes. Wow. Yeah. Well, this is why I like to not just have a local copy of my photos library in Apple's format, but take the master photos and data in it and copy that over to my disk station, because then it's in my format, right? It's just a folder of files and I it's not going to be manipulated. Although I think I probably let it delete things from that too when I do my sync. So maybe I need to rethink that and do what you do, Adam, and make it a one-way sync so that...
I also copied these to the Synology as
obviously.
Well, just for the record.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. We assumed that. That's right. Huh.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I'll offer my solution on these is, of course, I have my own server that I lease for my personal domain, and for years I did a blog on it and all that. And what one of the things they frown upon, although I haven't been griped at for doing it, is storing it, using it as an external drive, so to speak, or a cloud drive. But I took all my videos of the kids, those precious ones, and I put them up there, and then I just created a little page with a link to each of those videos. But the other thing that I've done is I use Plex. If you haven't bought yourself a lifetime Plex pass, I'm telling you, people, it's some of the best money you'll ever spend. Create a Plex pass, and in there, I've got a home videos folder. And so that folder actually lives on my Synology drive, but Plex points to it and serves it, and that's where I'm able to easily find and access my home videos.
Yep.
So,
yeah, I had that folder. These videos were not in there.
Oh.
I had not put them on Plex, but yeah. I will now. But
yeah, right.
I had other video. Yeah. I had other videos. I had the three theater performances my daughter did in elementary school. But
yep, yeah. I definitely do that now. I need to go back and make sure that all the things that I think are in my, you know, home videos library on Plex are there. I will note, and I will agree first, that the Plex pass is fantastic and allows a lot of great features. But adding your own videos to your Plex library is not one of them. That's something you can do with the free version of Plex.
Oh, right. Okay.
So, so don't feel like you can start and do a lot of things with Plex absolutely for free. The big one that comes with a Plex Pass is the ability to download from your library to your devices so that you can watch offline from like your iPhone or your iPad when, say, on an airplane or in a hotel room or whatever. You get some other controls. You get the ability to stream to the Plex Amp app, which is the music app that you can use like in your car and things like that. So there are things that you get with the Plex Pass paid license. But putting your own movies in Plex is something everybody can do for free, and it's a core feature.
Oh, that's great news.
Yeah.
I just assumed you couldn't do that, but yeah.
No, that's kind of what Plex is for, is your media library. Yeah. So, yeah.
And I'll tell you what, I think you and I did it about the same time. It was like $75 for a lifetime pass. I think it's about $129 or something.
It's $119 right now. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, but here's the thing about that. It's been probably 8 to 10 years since I bought it, and it gets cheaper by the year, obviously. I didn't think, you know, it's one of those things when you do it, you go, well, if they go belly up next year, I'm out $75. And if Plex isn't going anywhere, it doesn't appear. Looks like they're here for the long term.
Right.
So,
yeah. Yep. Yeah. They've diversified their business enough that I feel like it's fairly stable. So,
yeah.
Yep. There was a question asked and answered in our Discord community that I thought was a helpful thing. Crazy Ninja Papa asked, how do people who use their Synologies update their Docker containers? And so what he's asking is, when you create a Docker container on anything, which could be your Synology, could be on your Mac, could be on your Raspberry Pi, you download the Docker image, and that is sort of its own little sandboxed operating system that has sort of the bits and pieces of Linux that it needs, and of course the binaries to run your app. Well, apps like Plex, you could be running, let's say you're running Plex in a Docker container. You don't have to, there's many ways to do it, but that's one of them. Plex gets updates fairly regularly. When you download the Docker image, it runs Plex. You point it at your data store, which also has all your preferences and everything. That's great. But if Plex gets updated, you don't have the update because you have the Docker container that existed when you downloaded it. What's cool is if you do update the Docker container, all your data and your settings remain consistent. So you can kind of update it separate from your data, which is awesome. But that upgrade process is never easy, or hasn't been easy or fun, or at least isn't on the surface. So Crazy Ninja Papa asks, do I need to rebuild my whole Docker containers? Do I need to stop and restart? How do I make sure that my Docker containers remain up to date? And Crazy Ninja Papa answered with the solution that I use, which is, he says, R.N. Doug answered Crazy Ninja Papa, saying, I use Watchtower, and it has been great in my experience. This might even qualify as a cool stuff found. It certainly qualifies as something worthy of talking about in the show. I love Watchtower for doing this. It checks once a day all of my Docker containers, and I even configured it to send me an email when they're updated, so I know when things get updated. Synology's Container Station, which is what they call their Docker manager now, also has the ability to update the Docker container from within it. But I find that it doesn't see the updates as quickly, like by days or weeks, as Watchtower does. And Watchtower, it's one of these meta things that you run as a Docker container and it updates your Docker containers. So, you go figure that out. But there's an article on Marius Hosting, which is a great little how-to of installing Watchtower on your Synology, and they walk you through it. Marius's how-tos for doing things on your Synology and getting set up with things are so perfect. And in fact, I linked to the wrong one, or I pulled up the wrong one during the show. I will put a better one in place, but before you ever get to see it, folks. So yeah,
I love his stuff. It is so well written and point at illustrated and do this next.
Yep. He treats you like a dummy in the best way possible.
Thank you. Yes. It's like, yeah, please.
Yep. Treat me like a dummy. If I think I'm smart enough to skip a step, I will. Sometimes I get caught. Yep. Right. It's my own fault. Yeah. Well, he makes it so simple, and he assumes that you don't want to use the terminal to do things, so he uses the task scheduler to have you run terminal commands that you could just launch the terminal and do. I often will just go to the terminal on my disk station and do it because I'm comfortable with that, and I've already set all that up. But he walks you through it in a way that just makes it easy for anyone with a default config of their disk station, and there's so many how-tos out there, so yeah.
Yeah. And one of my favorites, and I know we've talked about this on the show before, is that he runs a honeypot to get who to ban from trying to access your Synology drive that's exposed to the cloud. So he has those blacklists that I think it's $8 to get that blacklist, and last I checked, it was over 90,000.
Yep.
IP addresses that he bans, and we've talked about it. I ban mine permanently. Once there's three login attempts, if someone hasn't hit his but they hit my Synology, if they do more than three login attempts badly in an hour, they're banned permanently.
Huh.
So, and I did manage to ban myself once.
I was just gonna say I ban things for 24 hours for that reason. So that if I'm traveling and I've locked myself out, I can get back in the next day.
Well, what I did is to then just use, I did manage to do it while I was on the road. So I just used my PIA VPN, changed my IP address and went in.
Yeah, of course.
And did it right that way. So.
Yeah. Yep.
But yeah.
Yep.
But it's bad when you ban your own home address.
That's kind of why I use the block list. He has made this year, Marius has made a significant change to the way he keeps the block list updated and removes things from it. So there used to be 70, 80, like you said, 90,000 addresses in the list. It's down to about 50,000 now. And he removes things that have not been problematic for X number of months or something. What I do when I add his block list is you import it into your disk station, and you can tell it when you're importing it when to expire these. I import it once per month, and I tell it to expire after 60 days. So if I get lazy and don't do it next month, I still have the block list for a little while. But this way, I'm not just keeping Marius's block lists that he's expiring out. I'm letting them expire from mine as well. So
I have a stupid question.
Yeah.
Why?
Because
why expire it?
Because it's possible. Well, do you remember my issues with Ticketmaster, Pete, where they would not let the range that my ISP had bought from a nefarious VPN provider, they would not let me buy tickets because their system their system had that range in their block list, and they weren't expiring it out on a schedule, and they were blocking something that had changed its purpose over time. So that's why I don't just keep things blocked permanently.
Yeah. Okay. Well, my argument would be, if you were Ticketmaster, sure, you want customers to be able to access your site, but you're not. You're Dave.
Yeah, but I want you to be able to access my server. And if you were to have moved to BreezeLine, which was the ISP that acquired these addresses, you would not be able to get into my server if I had kept these addresses blocked in perpetuity. IP address, there are a fixed number of IPv4 addresses out there, and they've all been assigned. That was true as of about a decade ago, right? So they do keep changing purpose, and they are valuable. So these nefarious companies that initially grabbed IPs so that they could run like free VPNs and capture all your data and do bad things, they're finding that their asset that they have on their balance sheet of these IP addresses is worth more to sell for good purposes than it is to use for nefarious purposes. So these IP addresses do change purpose all the time, and that's why I expire them out.
Okay.
And that's my story, enough. And I'm sticking with it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, nope. I'm keeping mine blocked. You ain't getting in. Only you and me need to get in. If you ain't getting in, then you can tell me and I'll unblock
you'll
you.
You'll unblock me. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So. Oh, all right, man.
You had something to add to that, Adam, or no?
No. Okay. No, I'm in agreement with you on the expiring because again, even if you don't change ISPs, your ISP could buy that block. Like Dave's ISP could buy that block and dynamically assign it to him at some point. And
yeah. Now I'm blocking myself and yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You don't know. Yeah. 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 So
fair enough.
60 days. That's what.
Yeah. You got to wait 60 days to get yourself back in then, but well, automatically. You know,
that's right. Hopefully it all works out in the wash. Yeah. Well, plus I have my daughter lives in Italy and her connection is on like many people in Europe, her home connection is a 5G connection, right? They've got a little box that grabs 5G over the air and routes it to Wi-Fi. And so her IP changes all the time and who knows what people are buying and selling over there. It's probably way more common there than here. So it's all kind of part of the system.
Yeah. Good point.
Yeah.
All right. Well, how about I take us to Bob's question?
Let's do it.
So he writes in, for the past several months, my 16-gigabyte Mac Mini M1 running Sonoma 14.4 and 14.5 often slows to a crawl on wake up. Every process seems to be stuck in molasses. Today I woke up my Mini at about 13:45 and it ran really slowly. Looking at the CPU activity, a process named Wallpaper Video Extension was running at about 80 to 90% CPU. Cores 5 through 8 were running at over 50%, and the CPU temperature was at 147 degrees, 40 degrees higher than normal. I let it run that way for an hour and then force quit the Wallpaper Video Extension using the Activity Monitor app. The only way I found to resolve this problem is to launch Activity Monitor app and force quit the process. Normal quit did nothing. I've seen a number of others who have this problem. Apple Support has not responded to explain or fix this issue, nor, after searching online, have there been any alternatives to the force quit method. I have no use for a video screensaver or wallpaper and have never used it. Any ideas on how to fix this? Permanently stopping any video screensaver or wallpaper would be just fine. Bob.
So, as I read this, I was reminded of an issue that I have, and it's when I go to remote into my studio Mac here, and I often will remote into it to do something, either from my laptop or from my Mac Mini down in the office, and I have three screens on this. When I remote in, the first thing that happens is it wakes everything up. I have dynamic wallpaper on two of my screens, and I have the logo of whatever podcast I'm recording on the third one. And when a Mac wakes up that has dynamic wallpaper, it goes through this, like, I'll call it a fly-in. It's different depending on what the wallpaper is, but it animates until it kind of settles in on what today's view is going to be. And that's all fine and good when I'm sitting here at the Mac. But when you're remoting in and there's this motion happening, it really slows down the process. And so as I was reading his question and thinking about this, I wondered if that the wallpaper video extension is what's responsible for that. And maybe on his machine, it's not stopping, or it maybe visually stops but still runs in the background. So my thought was to turn the wallpaper on your computers away from the default of the dynamic wallpaper and to a static image or simply a single color or something much, much more simple and easy for our Macs to do. And I changed that immediately on the Studio Mac as soon as I had this thought. And remoting in has been a so much smoother process. I'm able to, like, it saves me 10 seconds because I'm not waiting for this thing to, it's like, no, I just want to type my password and, you know, let's do the thing and then get out. And so that I wonder if changing the wallpaper to something not dynamic would be. And I'm not talking about the one where it changes from wallpaper to wallpaper, although that might also cause this. I'm talking about the ones that the actual wallpaper is dynamic over time, where it changes either the view or the time. You know, you can see what's Europe like during the day or at night or whatever. And like, it's cool. But if you don't care about that, then turn it off. Thoughts, Adam?
Well, I immediately went to check what my setup was, and I can confirm I'm using the changed from day, middle of day, early morning, night one, the Big Sur dynamic one. And my activity monitor for that process shows zero.
Great.
Like nothing. Nothing is happening. Maybe it's only going to fire up when it actually is transitioning. I don't know. I think you're probably spot on. The interesting thing was he said he doesn't have any use for those types of wallpapers and doesn't use them. So that's the only thing that I'm confused about, is if he is just using a static image, why would that process even be running at all? Like, because I said on mine, I have dynamic wallpaper and that video extension is zero CPU. It's been running for 3 hours, 3+ hours at this point now. So,
yeah, mine, let's see, I have the wallpaper image extension, the wallpaper video extension, and they're both currently using zero. I am using static images. Like, there's two types of wallpaper. I guess one is the aerial wallpaper, right? Which is like what you see on the Apple TV, and it's the moving one. And then there's the dynamic wallpapers, which are like the you know, the ones that are the weird color schemes that, like you said, change day and night and all that stuff. So,
video
static images. So.
Yeah, just the video ones, I would think, would cause that extension to run, like the aerial ones.
Yeah, the aerial ones. Yeah, exactly. Yep.
I'll have to check. I am using one of those on my work machine, so I'll have to check there. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like something's running amok, and maybe it's change away from whatever wallpaper you're using to something else and see if that just solves the problem. It might be a damaged file of whatever it is, and it's constantly trying to, like that's kind of how those things can go. Who knows?
So. Yeah. I mean, even just switching away from it and then switching back.
Yes.
If you do prefer that, you know, that one, maybe it just needs a reset, like a equivalent of turn it off and back on again.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Well, all good things, my friends.
All good things.
All good things.
I hear musica.
There's a lot left over, though, and so that means we have to do this again next week. No, you know what that means? We get to do this again next week.
There you go.
Looking forward to that.
Thanks to all those people.
Yes.
Out there.
All of you out there, whether you can see us pointing at you or not. That's right. Yeah.
Not nice to point.
No, you're right. It's not nice to point. It's not nice to point. We're full of great advice here. Thank you for hanging out with us. Thank you for sending in all your questions. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing the show. I've seen so many of you do that. It's amazing. Thanks to CashFly for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. Make sure you go check out Pete's Aviation Podcast. So There I Was. And I have two other shows, Business Brain and Gig Gab. We've been sharing lots of advice. I heard a piece of advice this week that I had never heard before, but Pete, you might have heard. It's do not add to the population. Do not subtract from the population. Do not wind up in the headlines, the hospital, or jail. If you do wind up in jail, establish dominance quickly. Pete, do you have anything to add to that?
Oh, well, even though I was in the headlines a couple weeks ago, I didn't, and you shouldn't either. Don't get caught.
Made on America.
See ya.
Later.